go. 3, 2, 1. All right. So, what we got? Sunday, February 23rd, 2014, 10:45 a.m. EST. That fainted music in the background is some stuff from freemusicarchive.org. Still Pluto, Bitter Pill featuring Vosmoy. You know, I don't know. Enjoy. Anyway, so here's another episode by me, Roberto. You can contact me, BETO at haven'tfoundme.com, or you can reach me on Twitter or Identica at haven'tfoundme. I'm on Google Plus as well. You can track me down there. Anyway, I just want to say hello and hope everyone's having a good Sunday. We're just gonna go over a couple things that I've kind of noticed in the past week that I felt that, okay, is some pretty good stuff. I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing with my podcast recordings, but I did see on the Hacker Public Radio site that there were topics that they wanted some individuals to, or they, you know, topics that you can contribute information or content on. One of the top, few of the topics that interest me and that I definitely may be providing some content for I see one here for an introduction to Wireshark. What I would actually like to do is just do an introduction to TCP dump, because if you can work with TCP dump, then once you dive into Wireshark, you'll understand why Wireshark exists and you know where it came from. So yeah, TCP dump and elipsCAP libraries. Yeah, I think those two pieces right there are going to be just absolutely amazing if you can just wrap your mind around those tools. Once you get into Wireshark, then it's like wonderful. It's just wonderful. Anyway, so another one that I noticed was installing a VPN to your home network. The episodes for the LPI or the networking series. So I wonder if the LPI is just LPIC 1, LPIC 2, LPIC 3. There's a lot of information there, especially in like the LPIC 1, LPIC 2 series, because there's just so much and there's just so much that you can experiment with. Networking series, I wonder if they're kind of like, you know, like a CCNA type of series, like, or just, you know, OSI or TCP/IP layer breakdown information, a breakdown of the TCP/IP OSI layer information. I don't know if that's kind of what people are interested in, but I am interested in creating some episodes based off of those. Another one that I think was very interesting, well, two or three more that I feel that are really interesting was how to fix a car. I think it's really important. It kind of sucks nowadays because you have a lot of cars rely a lot on the computer codes, or the error codes or reporting codes you get from the cars. So I don't really know how to work with cars in that fashion because I don't have the module that you can connect into cars, and then you can connect it to your Linux laptop, and then you can actually read the codes from the car using some command line tools. I've seen that on YouTube, and I thought that was pretty cool because then if you were into dynoing your own car and you could understand the output from your car, you can optimize your car or whatever. But I think like how to fix your car, like, you know, how to change a flat tire or, you know, some common tools to have in your car. Also just, you know, changing the oil or basic stuff like windshield wipers, checking your fluids, you know, adding some fluids, you know, what's the right and wrong things to do, what are the resources to go to. Usually the car manual is like the best thing to read, that thick ass manual that's in your car that they give you. It's usually the best thing to read. It gives you a lot of good pointers, and it helps you identify all the parts on the car or all the places on the car. But yeah, I mean, like how to fix a car in essence of like how to repair a transmission, how to repair an engine, doing things like that. Yeah, that's tough. I don't know how that's going to be done on audio. That's going to be really tough. But there's a how to set up a GPG and open PGP. I mean, I can set up my own keys, but if this is talking about like setting up a server, then okay, I can kind of understand and see where that's going. But the what I do with my Raspberry Pi, yeah, that's really interesting. There's so many things you can do with a Raspberry Pi. It's pretty ridiculous. Yeah, so those are some of the ones that interest me a lot. And I think, as time goes on, I hope to make a couple episodes based off of them. Definitely on the Wireshark and definitely on Wireshark, VPN, and the Raspberry Pi, because those are three things that I've dived into heavily in the past couple months. Some of the other ones that pop up are the Grub 2.0 introduction and customization. I like Grub. It works. There's Lilo or Lilo, however you want to call it, but I don't know if Lilo does Lilo boot into other than Linux OSs. I don't know, and I don't know anymore. All I know is Grub. All I know is that Grub can boot into other OSs, and that's that. And then I like the one that says how to build a house. That's really interesting. I know someone who they're really good. They're a really excellent handyman, and I wonder like just if I can talk to this individual and say, hey, can we record like how-to videos or something on like how to repair a busted pipe, or how do you repair, or how do you what are some of the household things you need, to kind of have like a to be energy efficient or something like that. Like, I don't know. It's just, that one's really interesting because, in nowadays we kind of do spend a lot of time. Once we do, I don't live in a home. I don't have a home, but I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of work and a lot of self-education that goes along with having a home. And building a house is cool. That's awesome. Like, right. You build a foundation, you build a framework, and then you just, slap everything on. Like that's just amazing. But then just maintaining a household, now that's really interesting because it's like there's just so many things you can do to maintain a household. I mean, this is, like there's just so many things you can do. Like if you have like a gas boiler, I'm not a gas boiler, but is it a boiler or anyway, a hot water tank. You got a gas. If you use gas to heat up your hot water, sometimes that thing that goes out, sometimes, you're not home to turn that on, and you've got to explain to your wife like, okay, you've got to turn the knob here, hold it down, hit the igniter, and then the igniter is going to start the is going to start the is going to start a flame, and then you got to turn it to the on position and put the cover back on, and then wait like 20 minutes for the water to heat up, and then you've got hot water, or you've got like the electrical, the electrical hot water tanks, or heating hot water tanks, whatever, the water heaters. There you go, electrical water heaters. They just they use electricity to heat up the water, but then like now your electric bill goes up. So how do you how do you combat against that? Like before, it's like, oh, now I got another bill because I got to pay for gas and I got to pay for electricity and I got to pay for water. Okay, I got rid of the gas bill because, I've got an electric stove and an electric water heater. But now, now your electric bill is going to go up a little bit. So it's just interesting. It's just kind of interesting stuff. And even like with central air, like some people, I understand a lot of people don't really have the for are not fortunate enough to experience central air in their household. A lot of people have to have like AC units, or they've got the electrical heaters, or they've got boilers, like the heating pipes that flow around your home. you know, some people are in that scenario, but sometimes, you know, in newer homes, you've got central air. So in the winter, you've got hot air coming out from the vents, and in the summer, you've got cold air coming out from the vents. And then depending on your household or the size of your household, you know, if you're like the furthest room, if you're in the furthest room away from where that air is being pushed out from, you know, you're gonna get like a little bit of air. You know, you're gonna get like the, you know, think of it as you know, everyone that's closest to to where the air is being pushed out from is gonna get, you know, the nice cool air. But if you're in that one room that faces like that weird, you know, east, it faces east, and the sun hits it like from the morning to night, and it's just, you know, you're trying to stay cool, but you're in the room, and then the sun is just heating up the room from morning to night, and you can't escape the rays of the sun all day until it's nighttime, and you're the room that's furthest away from where the air is being distributed from. You know, you're gonna be sweating in that room because it's just gonna be too hot. And if you didn't close the vents to like some of the other rooms that aren't being used, or to like the bathroom or something like that, you know, like basically to force the air to push itself towards your room, you know, it's gonna suck. So, you know, it's just how to build a house is just interesting, but then like how to maintain a household, you know, like what are some of the nuances that you experience in your household, and what have you done to, you know, to solve those? I think that's a really cool topic. But anyway, yeah, a lot of the other ones are interesting. I don't know how they're gonna be done without video, but how to solder, how to weld, that those are gonna be pretty interesting. The FM transmitter hack to listen into internet streams, that sounds pretty cool. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Anybody who can do that is yeah, you're a ninja. Init and System D, that one's pretty cool. If you in the past built your own init scripts, I think you should definitely contribute to that topic, because just building init scripts is like it's awesome. But then now we're going to System D, so it's, you know, you better start learning those System D commands to start up services and stuff. So anyway, those are just a lot of those are some of the few requested topics. And if you would like to record a show on one of these topics, please email admin@hackerpublicradio, and they will take it off the list. So if you go to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php, or just go to the contribute page, you'll see the list there, like 3/4 of the way down from the site. So so anyway, what I want to talk about today are couple things. As you probably read from the episode title, it's gonna be X-Face, and X-Ubuntu. It's gonna be Chromebook end of life, CentOS, let's see, Bridge Linux, Bedrock Linux, Indiegogo, some YouTube channels I came across, and a couple of other things here and there. So the first thing I want to talk about is X-Face and X-Ubuntu. The crew, I've on my last episode, I talked about X-Ubuntu. I like X-Ubuntu. I support X-Ubuntu. I do know that I'm not going to stick with X-Ubuntu just because it's just, I don't know, it's just my nature. I'm probably going to end up doing something else or looking for something else. It's definitely not going to be committing to Chromebook, because later on, as I explained, or Chrome OS. Because later on, as I explain, Chromebooks are going to reach an end of life, which, like, it's like a WTF moment. Like, you know, I bought this, you know, $200 laptop because I wanted to save money. I like the hardware, and I buy stuff because they're going to last. Like, you know, I have, you know, my laptop here. I've had it for 2 years now. I buy these things because they're going to last, and I want them to last. And that's what's important to me is, you know, when you start looking at, like, Linux distributions that can support, you know, 128 megs of RAM or Pentium 3 processors, you start to ask yourself, like, okay, why does that even exist? But then it's like, well, there's a lot of old hardware out there, and that old hardware can be clustered and used in efficient ways. It's just, you know, I just think that's, you know, I just think that's still a value. No matter, you know, you could recycle it, get rid of it, or whatever, but still, it's still valuable to someone. So end of life in Chromebooks, within like a 5 year or 6 or 7 year time frame. I mean, okay, I kind of understand that. Like, all right, that makes sense. You know, 5 years, it should already be old and outdated. But I mean, there's some people that are running MacBooks that are like over 5 years old. Like, you know, they're running MacBooks right now that are over 5 years old and they run just fine. You know, they've got 8 gigs of RAM in them things. They've got like S, they're running like, you know, SS, they're running 128 gig, you know, SATA 2 SSDs, and they still got Core 2 Duo or Core Quad, you know, processors in there, and it works, it functions, it can, it, they survive, you know, the hardware can continue. Yes, Apple does end of life their hardware by, you know, deprecating them through their software updates, but that doesn't mean that you can't still use the laptop with Linux or even with Windows, because I mean, you know, you could still use it with the old OS, but then you have like, you know, security vulnerabilities because you may not get, you know, updates anymore or security updates. But still, I mean, you can still boot camp the thing and maybe use Windows if you wanted to, just to, you know, for shits and giggles. But I'm just saying, it's still kind of weird for me because with Chromebook, I mean, it's not like you're able to easily install another OS. I mean, yes, you have Krypton. Yes, you can install Xubuntu on top of Chrome OS. But I haven't really seen, I mean, unless you're really hacking away at the Mario stuff. What is it? Is it Mario Bootloader? I think it's the Mario Bootloader or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, if you're really, really, really like hacking away at the core boot stuff, because the core boot stuff is like what secures the Chromebook and stuff. I mean, it's like, all right, I kind of get it. I understand, you know, I kind of understand what's going on there, but my problem with that is just, again, I want my hardware to last, you know, and if I can't do anything else after this thing's end of life, and if it becomes, you know, a hassle or some sort of issue, or just doesn't let me start up the machine, you know, that's gonna suck. You know, that's really gonna suck. So anyway, so yeah, so XFACE and Xubuntu, they're really good. I really enjoy them. LXDE is cool, but I just had a lot of problems with using that. And the reason why I'm using lightweight, the reason why I'm using lightweight desktop environments is because I really like running a lean machine. So like for instance, you know, if I'm running free, you know, if I run the command free-m or vmstat, you know, I want to see that I'm using nothing. You know, like right now I'm using nothing. Like if I have the browser open, yeah, I've got Chrome, I got Firefox open, and all right, yeah, it's using a hellacious amount of resources. But you know what? That's just Chrome. I mean, that's just Firefox. Chrome is the same scenario as well. It, you know, lots of resources used, but whatever, not a big deal. I'm not, you know, too bummed about that. I just really enjoy having a very lean desktop, and at the same time, I don't want to have to max out my RAM like nowadays or today or like in the present time in order to satisfy, you know, my work habits. You know, if let's say, you know, if I had this laptop for 2 years, and then 3 years from now it starts to get really old and really slow, and then I can add another 4 gigs of RAM to it. Now I've got my 8 gigs of RAM or 16 gigs of RAM or whatever is the maxed out, you know, RAM capacity, and you know, the fastest SSD I can put on this thing, you know, just clean it out real quick and say, all right, it's refreshed. You know, I install a new distro, lightweight distro environment, lightweight desktop environment. It should run perfectly fine. So that's kind of my mentality, is that 5 years this thing should still be running, and I shouldn't really have too many issues. But you know, who knows? Who knows what could happen, right? But anyway, so your XFACE and Xubuntu is good. Krypton for Google Chromebook is awesome, and I just love the fact that I get XFACE and Xubuntu when I use Krypton. So what's next? Let's see. I'm not going to stick with Ubuntu much longer. I came across this site that has a I came across this Wikipedia page, and It's a layout of the, it's called the GNU Linux Distribution Timeline, version 12.10. The authors look like they're Lundquist and Rodick. They're at futurist.se/GLDT. And it's published under the GNU Free Documentation License. So basically it's a timeline from 1992 to 2013 of all the major, of all the distributions. It seems like it's all the Linux distributions, GNU Linux distributions you can think of, and more. It's tons and tons of stuff with their start dates and kind of like their faded out, end of life slash, you know, what the hell's going on. The reason why I said I don't think I'll be sticking with Ubuntu, from a personal, like from a personal desktop perspective, much longer, is because a couple things. So Debian, I really love Debian. I've always loved Debian. It's a pain in the ass, but you know, I really love Debian. But I've always had an interest in Slackware, and I don't know if maybe it's like, you know, the joke could be this is the year of the Linux desktop. This is the year of the Linux desktop, and then the next, like a meta joke could be this is the year of Slackware. You know, like this is the this is this is the this is the decade of Slackware. You know, I don't know. This is something to think about, but I think what's kind of disrupted Slackware's progression is Arch. So Arch is becoming a very, very, very popular and a very good distro. It started from its own origin, which is okay. That's really cool. I like that. And then some of you may be thinking, well, what about Red Hat? And I was like, well, the recent, not acquisition or buyout, but the recent integration of CentOS with Red Hat, kind of, you know, it makes me think about some things. It makes me think about some past assumptions I had, you know, because Oracle Unbreakable Linux was, you know, it's like the very best alternative to Red Hat because it's supported by Oracle and it was cheaper, and it's just Red Hat with the rebranded stuff from Oracle. And then the other option you had was CentOS, which was just the stripped down community version of Red Hat. So it's like, okay, you know, that's pretty cool. And you know, the packages are maintained from the community. So, you know, in my mind, in the past, I thought that CentOS was the committed OS for enterprise solutions, where if you knew Linux and you understood what you were doing and you knew how to build, you know, clusters and storage, you know, SANs or whatever. If you knew what you were doing, basically, I felt that CentOS was like the best option because it could provide that upgrade path for any organization to say, all right, we're gonna spend money on really good Linux admins and have them build stuff with open source and, you know, free and open source tools and applications. And as time goes on, if we do need support or we do find ourselves in a bind where we do need, you know, special packages or something of that nature, you know, at least they can make that next step going into Red Hat wouldn't be that bad. It wouldn't be that difficult, I felt. So that's kind of what I was thinking, was like CentOS is like the first step, and if you needed to make a next step into a more professional, and we need to show, you know, from a disaster recovery and this assurance and this, you know, CIA and, you know, this InfoSec perspective of, hey, you know, I need to assure our investors or our backers that, you know, in the event of a disaster or in the event that of a vulnerability, we're covered. You can move on to Red Hat, get the Red Hat updates, you know, and get the Red Hat support, and you're good to go. Or get the Oracle stuff and you're good to go. So now that CentOS and Red Hat are, you know, it's CentOS is not Fedora. You know, Fedora Core is the bleeding edge. It's the stuff that, makes you your head go around and around trying to fix sometimes. But you once you understand Fedora and you work with Fedora, you're like, okay, wonderful. I see where Red Hat is going. I see where most Linux distributions are going. This is really good. CentOS is like, this is Red Hat. Like, this is RHEL, 6 or RHEL 7. CentOS 6 dot whatever is Red Hat 6 dot whatever. It's not, there is, or is RHEL 6 dot whatever. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So, I don't know. I kind of just thought that it was a good option. And if you had the resources, it was a good distro to commit to and to return, to put back, to put back what you took out of it. But, this whole like integration of CentOS with Red Hat now, it's interesting. It's interesting. But anyway, going back to the timeline, this timeline, page, it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. You can read through all these OSs that you're just like, wow, like, whatever happened to them, like Nopix, Nopix is still out there, but it's just not as big as it used to be. Like 5, 6, 7 years ago, Nopix was like the thing to use. Like, don't mess around with anybody. Like, 7 years ago, if you had a Nopix CD, someone was like, wow, this guy's gonna fix everything, it's just that kind of mentality. So, and then it's also a little, it's a little educate that you gain a little bit of education out of it as well. So, for instance, I didn't know this. Maybe I did, but I definitely did, don't think I knew this. But you have Nopix came from Debian. So you have Debian. So Nopix came from Debian. And then Canonix came from Nopix. And then Auditor Security Linux came from Canonix. And then Backtrack came from Auditor Security Linux. And then, as we know, well, I don't see Kali on here, but Kali Linux comes from, we know it's sourcing, it's, we know underlyingly it's Debian. So it's kind of interesting. It's kind of interesting, so anyway, damn vulnerable Linux. If you are if you are looking into, focusing more on security, or trying to, you're interested in doing some sort of hacking and stuff, damn vulnerable Linux. If you can revive that distro, that was a good distro. It was damn vulnerable. I could tell you that right now. So anyway, so it's a very good page. Of course, this will be on the show notes. But if you want to go to it, it's futurist.se/gldt. And again, it's called the GNU Linux Distribution Timeline, version 12.10. All right. So up next, I've got, I already expressed my stuff about CentOS, but I have here like CentOS, WTF, so server side, what's next? That's my question. Like, server side, what's next? What's the next major distro we're gonna commit to for server side stuff? Are we gonna start rebuilding? Is everybody gonna start from, is everyone gonna start from, what is the Linux from scratch? Just build their own distro and then, make their own server software, and that's it, or their server OS, and then that's it. Use any packages they want or whatever. I don't know. That's kind of, that's kind of my question about CentOS and Red Hat. Like, what's going on there? And Fedora is not, you should not use Fedora as like a production server unless you're really good at, what you do. I mean, maybe you can, no big deal if it's not like, if it's not, high availability or anything like that. Like, if its priority is not like, high, maybe medium to low, maybe you should be okay. Just because, from a disaster recovery perspective, you're gonna be like, oh crap, I can't be using Fedora as, my production environment. That's a big chance you're taking, especially if you're short-staffed, or if the learning curve is really high for some of your sysadmins or anything like that. So building your own distro from the ground up, It is a lot of work. I've been looking at two distros that I feel that are kind of interesting. The first thing I want to do, I do want to say, is that Marcus Ranham, I think he's a chief security officer at Tenable Networks. No, I'm sorry, not Tenable. Nessus. Is it? Yeah, Tenable makes Nessus, right? So Marcus Ranham, he had a really good talk in the past about his, I would say, like the his naming of Bastion host. Like he coined the term Bastion host. And you know, if you're not familiar with what a Bastion host is, just think of it as a dedicated OS to just do one thing and one thing only. You know, you build a Linux OS to do one thing and one thing only. So like a firewall, you know, if you build a firewall, it's a Bastion host. You know, like just build one OS or server to just do that one thing. You strip every other package out of it. Just take every single package out of there that you don't need. You know, just you don't need, I don't know, like it, just think of it like that. You just, you know, I don't want to say you could take the ARP firewall tables out, because maybe you still want to use ARP tables or ARP firewall tables, but just think of it as you just build a dedicated firewall, and that's all that it does. It does not do anything. It's not a web server. It's not a syslog server. It doesn't do anything else except just be a firewall. That's what a Bastion host is. He's kind of reneging on that. On that term now, where he's like, he feels that, you know, it was a good concept in the past, where you just had one system do one thing and one thing only very well, but the landscape of security is becoming so, it's just becoming so overwhelming that building one dedicated system to do to do only one thing and one thing only could actually be like the Achilles heel for your entire, you know, security infrastructure. And that sucks. That, you know, it really sucks, because it's like, you know, you got to think about it. It's just like, damn, that sucks. So I have here: make way for clusters, customized systems, but generic and widely supported desktops. Sounds like Slackware to me. So this goes back to my whole premise on, you know, I feel Slackware, Arch, or some OSs that are going to start to become really, some OSs are going to start to bounce back for some reason. And I don't know. I don't know why I'm just saying that, but I just have a feeling that some OSs are going to start bouncing back. You're going to have the easy OSs, like the easy desktop environments, like Ubuntu and Mint, to spin up and you'd be good to go. But, you know, you got to really start thinking about, if you're a sysadmin, or if you're like, you know, if you're knee deep into like infrastructure stuff, you know, it's everything is about clustering, high availability, and just, you know, seamless, like seamless, what would you say, like seamless service transitions, right? Like or seamless upgrades, or whatever. You're not gonna, no, like there aren't gonna be outages the way we see outages today. Like, oh, you know, this server's down, you know, for 20 minutes, we bring it back up and whatever. Like, I don't think we're gonna have outages like that in the future. But clusters wise, like, you know, like clusters and stuff like that are gonna be really, really important stuff to focus on. But customized systems, I think we're getting, I don't know, I think we're getting there. I don't know if we're going back to like the whole Bastion host concept, but we're getting somewhere where there's customized systems. Because like, just look at Arch's Pac-Man stuff, and you know, I don't know, but I mean, Gentoo is still popular. It's still very popular, and you know, that's all I can say. That's all I can say is that a lot of these things are, there's just, I don't know, there's something in the pot there, and it's brewing. It's brewing. So well, then the next thing that leads me into is two OSs that I'm interested in: Bridge Linux and Bedrock Linux. So if something's brewing in the pot right now, then right now is a good time to start either committing to a really young, an either young branch of a distro or some totally new distro that does something, different. Because it's going to have a low amount of developers, a small amount of developers, a small community, just that it's a small, I would say, it's a small OS, or it's a small kind of like a, it takes up a small amount of space in the size of Linux and the GNU/Linux distribution timeline. Like when you look at the GNU/Linux distribution timeline, you just pick one distro there and you're like, yeah, this thing is like so small in comparison to what exists out there. But if you think about it and you start like saying, yeah, it's really small in comparison to like what's out there, but the opportunities for you as like if you're interested into working with Linux, or if you're already in Linux and you just want to be part of like a community and actually make a name for yourself, the opportunities are like ginormous, because it's like, you can do whatever you want. You can you want to be the site admin, say, hey, I'll be the site admin. You want to be the forum, monitor, you can be the forum monitor. You want to be a kernel developer, you want to start, optimizing the kernel for this distro, you can do it. You want to start building packages, or you want to be a package maintainer, you can do it. If you want to do the if you want to do technical documentation, or the tech doc, or if you want to be like a quality assurance tester, you can do it. Especially on a distro that's like just coming up, where it's just there's like three or four, maybe five key developers, committed to it, or maybe just one guy, and just helping them out and committing to it, and just learning along the way all these things that you probably never heard about or never knew about. Like, I just think that that's really, really important now, because we can all flock to like Ubuntu or Fedora, or Arch, or any major community supported, any major distribution that has a large community base. But I think some of these small ones need some, tender love and care in a sense, or attention, because some of these guys are doing some really interesting stuff. So Bedrock Linux, they were in Ohio Linux Fest last year, and I just read over their stuff on their website. They've got an awesome website, by the way. So it's bedrocklinux.org. Awesome website. I'm not saying there's like anything magnificent in like in terms of HTML, CSS. I just like the plain fact that you got a couple ASCII, you got Bedrock and ASCII on the top left-hand corner. You've got menu navigation and some external links on just below the ASCII art, and then you just have it just seems like static site content on, just to scroll through, and it's just, it's just wonderful. I just like it. But anyway, so these guys are doing something pretty interesting. What I like is that they're saying, okay, you like Arch, you like Ubuntu, you like Red Hat, you like this, you like that, but your package manager, but when you're in Ubuntu, maybe the example that they had on their site was for a game. Oh man. So the example that they had on their site was for, I can't believe I forgot the damn game's name. But anyway, the example that they have was Bedrock's, let's see, how is this different from preferable to using a virtual machine? So basically what they're saying is that, what they do in Bedrock is they use like a Chroot to contain different versions of an OS. So you can basically have Ubuntu running in one path. You can have Firefox in that Ubuntu version running in that path, or you can execute Firefox to run in that Ubuntu version, or have Firefox run or run Firefox within like CentOS in another Chroot directory. So it's kind of interesting, and that's why the question here in their FAQs, in one of their FAQs, is like, how is this different from or preferable to using a virtual machine? Because that's what you're doing, right? Like, why don't you just use a virtual machine, and then you can just do whatever you want with the in a virtual machine. You don't have to deal with statically linked libraries. But anyway, so the example that they had was it's just an easier transition. And they had a really good example here about a game where the libraries were available in Ubuntu, and because the game was built, or the game was debugged, or it was debugged or tested on Ubuntu, but the stuff didn't work in Debian because Debian wasn't using the same libraries that Ubuntu was using. So it was just kind of this scenario where, okay, now you have to spin up, if you're using Debian, now you have to spin up Ubuntu just to play this game. But then their argument is that, well, you can just chroot into your Ubuntu directory, and now you're in Ubuntu, and then you can do whatever you want in Ubuntu. And if you needed to go back to Debian, you chroot into Debian, and then you could do whatever you want to do in Debian. So it's just a really good concept, and just stupid, simple, crazy stuff. So Bedrock Linux, check it out if you want. Another one was Bridge Linux, and I just like them. They're small and they're up and coming. I think their site is like millertechnologies.com, I think. But anyway, so moving on, Indiegogo. I haven't been able to. I haven't donated anything to any like Kickstarter or Indiegogo startups. But there was one that I wish I had the money. I wish I had the time and the money, because it was like I didn't know about it until like there were 7 hours left, and what I would have wanted to contribute for, I just didn't afford. I couldn't afford it. But there's this I Hate Being Single season 2. It's an Indiegogo project, and it was they had like 7 hours left when I it was like 7 hours left the other day, and I was like, oh crap. I was like, I wish I knew about this thing ahead of time. Oh no, they've just expanded it. So they I oh, okay, so it's 4 days left. Okay. Or maybe it was 7 days. Anyway, so you got a couple options here, and if I hate being single. It's just comedy. They're a bunch of Brooklyn hipsters, and well, to me they're hipsters. They don't want to claim themselves as hipsters. But anyway, if the different donating, I forget what these are called, but the perks, so the contributions. So you can have like $3,000. You can be at a vi you can be a video party or producer cred. $1,000 to be in the show. $500 to inspire a short episode, $250 a digi day or workshop with Rob, $100 team single, $50 Instagram video from on set, $25 personalized sad vine, $5 access behind the scenes. I think this is really awesome. I think this is really awesome for video. I think this is really great. So I would definitely would like to be on the show. So that's a But it's not there. The funds aren't there. So hopefully I'll be ready for season 3, or maybe they'll extend this, and maybe I'll be able to contribute. But yeah, so what I'm getting at is same thing with the whole Linux in with the whole Linux stuff I've been talking about is there's a lot of mainstream stuff that you can commit to, you can put your time and energy towards, and yeah, of course you're gonna put your time and energy towards that mainstream stuff because it's gonna, there's a large backing, there's a large amount of people, and there's a high success rate, from a risk analysis perspective, right? But at the same time, you're just kind of like joining the herd, right? You're just going along with everyone else. Now, it may make me sound a little hypocritical because I'm here recording an episode on Hacker Public Radio, but I don't know. I guess to each his own. But what I'm saying about the Indiegogo is that if you haven't done so already, please go ahead, find something and contribute. Because this is just I kind of think about the Pwnage series and how great that was. And once they went into Canadian television, I was so sad because it was like, oh man, like they're now they can't no more web series. I was like, man, that's. It sucks, these guys were they were really funny, and it was really entertaining, and it's just I hope they do end up making the movie, so find yourself something to contribute to, find yourself something small, big, whatever, just commit to it, work with it, and work towards your next goal, expand your knowledge, expand apply yourself, dive into things you haven't really done before, and learn new things, because that's gonna that's definitely gonna be that's definitely gonna be very helpful for anybody in the future. So those are pretty much everything that I have. A couple things that I noticed on YouTube, NCIX.com. So I guess this is a Canadian distributor. Like, they're kind of like Tiger Direct, but they have a really good YouTube series of just all types of hardware stuff. So dive into it. It's sim like Tiger Direct used to have, kind of like the, hey, check this out, this thing is like so cool and expensive and buy it. These guys are a little different. They're like, hey, how do you build like a, this is the difference between 40, like Bitcoin mining. They'll explain it. They'll talk about it. They'll show you hardware. They'll show you their rig. They'll show you, a couple of the stuff that you could buy from their site. But at the same time, it just seems like it's more informational than anything. They did have one. It was like the frames per second, and it was like 120 frames per second versus 40 frames per second. Like, can people tell the difference? And it was pretty good. It was a pretty good little test they did. But anyway, another one I have is DuckDuckGo, DuckDuckGo slash Goodies. If you haven't checked this out, I highly recommend DuckDuckGo slash Goodies. They have a whole bunch of cool stuff here. Under cryptography, you can say generate password 15. They have like these modules or something. I guess they're modules. And one is called like password 15 strong. So it gives you like a randomly strong 15 multi a random password, 15 characters, uppercase, lowercase, special characters, numbers, everything. So, it's pretty cool. They've got a couple other stuff, like a UUID generator, a hash computer. So basically, if you wanted to create like a cryptographic hash of, it's just really cool stuff. It's really cool stuff. The one that I like is the LeakDB module, which is like you can create like a you can create like a hash based off of a plain text value. So I thought that was, I think it's actually the reverse, but I think it's the reverse. But anyway, they have like a binary to ASCII converter. They have anagrams. They have under sysadmin tools. They have the Unix time converter. I know from Epochs, I've come across this a lot, especially if you don't have Perl available on your system, where you can use the actual Perl-E. Oh gosh, I forgot the command, but there's a converter in Perl that you can use to convert from Epoch to what is it, Julian, or they say text here, but I forget the calendar system. But yeah, so they have that there. They also have like a data rate conversions for system admin stuff. They show you the private network blocks. A lot of cool stuff there. Under travel, they've got like USD to Euro conversions. They got time conversions. They got Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion stuff. They have some web design goodies, so ASCII table, color codes. I know that's a big one. Once if you are doing web programming, I know you guys are like, what the hell is the damn color code for, I don't know, ultraviolet blue or something, I don't know, or ultraviolet, I don't know. So HTML characters, lorem ipsum. So if you need to generate some blah 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 stuff, there's your lorem ipsum stuff. There's a lot, I mean, there's a lot of cool goodies here. I mean, you can just use this stuff for days and days. This food and drink one is pretty cool. I think I'm gonna have to tell some people about this one. This is a teaspoon to tablespoon conversion. How to mix a Tom Collins, bartending information. This is really good stuff. So anyway, check it out. That's duckduckgo.com/goodies. Another thing that I came across. Let's see. So recently on Packet Pushers podcast, it's a net on the Packet Pushers network or Packet Pushers podcast. Anyway, so there was there, I was listening to a to an episode based on the Packet Pusher on the Packet Pusher network, and the podcast was about software-defined networking or automation, and or it's like programming in networking. So basically what I've noticed is that you can conduct a lot of automation using software-defined networking, but in the traditional networking infrastructure where you have like a CLI, you really need tools, or you really need like a vendor proprietary command line, not a command line integration, but like a configuration management system. So like for HP, HP has like HP. Oh man, they've got two versions. It's like IMI, I think. They've got two versions of their configuration management suite, and that's to help administer like HP Procurve switching hardware. So the problem is that sometimes those tools don't work as well as you want them to work. So then you've got to go back and use you got to like SSH into the switch, undo config or redo a config or reload a config or reboot the switch, or manually have to go out there and do all this crazy stuff on a switch. But there the episode that they were ta the episode that I was listening to was talking about using programming to help automate a lot of a lot of these nuances, a lot of these deployment or a lot of these procedural things that can be automated. So Python is a very, very good tool for automation for your network. There's a lot of good modules involved there. But in show 176, it was called Intro to Python and Automation for Network Engineers. It's the packetpushers.net, and it's the weekly show that they have. And it's show 176, Intro to Python and Automation for Network Engineers. They talk about it's they're very network the guys that are on that episode are very network centric, but if you can follow it and listen to what they've got to say, you'll kind of understand that, all right, programming is definitely important in programming is definitely going to be important if you're a network engineer, a sysadmin, whatever, or DevOps, a DevOps engineer. Anything that involves the infrastructure, or just networking and systems alone. So one of the things that they mentioned in that episode was Ansible. So if any of you have ever used like a configuration management or configuration deployment tool, such as like Puppet or Puppet Chef, or Ansible, or damn, there's another one. I can't think of the other one. But anyway, if you've used these type of tools before, you're already like 50%, on your way to like the next, stratosphere. I don't know. But or maybe you're already there. I don't know. But the thing is that what I'm trying to say is that I've looked into Puppet, I've looked into Chef. Those are really good tools. They're really awesome, because the way those tools work is that you go into an environment, like I start an environment, they tell me I need to automate, I need to automate the provisioning of 1,000 switches in like whatever time frame, and or I need to pull the reporting from 1,000 switches and off of uplink interfaces or something like that. They want reporting, they want report metrics on some information. The key is that these environments, what they do is that they can build these Puppet modules, or these they can build these modules to help in Puppet or Chef or whatever, or these I think in Chef they're called cook recipes, and then in Puppet I forget what they're called. In Ansible they're called playbooks. But anyway, it's kind of like these, they're you can think of them as scripts, but just more they're more like modules. And what you can do is just build a module or whatever that can go to every single switch in your environment. It connects to the APIs, to these supported networking devices, pull the information they need from there, whether if it's off of SNMP or whether it's off the API of the device, or whether it's like manual, like SSH, like manual labor SSH, SSH, what is that? Like, I forget, is that SSHTTY? But anyway, whether they're however you're pulling that information, you can build those modules and you can put it back into, the Puppet or whatever community, the configuration management, configuration deployment community that you're using, and then someone else can use that same module, modify it for their environment, and then, boom, they're able to, aggregate the downlink. They're able to aggregate, like the northbound, southbound, metrics of their infrastructure instantaneously, because you contributed back into, the community of whatever configuration community you're using. So if you're lost at this point on the things that I'm saying, I apologize, but I highly recommend packetpushers.net show 176 intro to Python and automation for network engineers. If you don't want to listen to that 1 hour and 10 minute episode, not a problem. Go to ansible.org, I believe, or Ansible Works or something like that, and just check them out. It's their playbooks are built on YAML, which is a markup language. Very easy to read, very easy to write. And you will be surprised at how simple it is to automate your in you to automate anything in your infrastructure using like a configuration management system. So I highly recommend you guys look into that. But at the same time, don't let go of those ten don't let go of those really important skills such as script writing, and just like basic salt like basic computer science concepts too. A lot of the times you hear people say, oh, just got to learn some code. I would say like there are some fundamental computer science concepts that you're going to need to know in order to be a little more successful in your script development or your configuration development or whatever. But anyway, so I hope that was enough information. I hope that was an enjoyable hour. But anyway, I hope everyone has a good week and or a good month or a good year, and just keep at it. Keep working towards whatever you're working towards. Remember to subscribe to the Hacker Public Radio RSS feed. If you want to if you want to email me, my contact information is beto@haven'tfoundme.com. You can connect with me on Twitter at haven'tfoundme or Identica at haven'tfoundme. And thank you for listening. Have a great day. Take care.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.